Hi everybody. This is Nick talking. Still coming to you from Beaconsfield. I just wanted to have this little intro because originally when Alex and I recorded this podcast, we recorded it on Sunday the 17th of May. So that was about 11 days ago. And we had, of course, a notion that there was definitely a cultural rationale to this episode because of the cancellation of the Cannes Film Festival due to political upheaval and the and yeah and the way that that contrasts in a way with the present. But I think I really couldn't quite anticipate it within the last couple of days how some of the images coming out of Minneapolis look eerily similar to the images coming out of France and Paris in that month of May, 52 years ago. And we're not really a political podcast. Of course, politics figures into our discussions of cinema. Of course, it's an inescapable facet whenever you're talking about movies and history, but I mean, I felt personally I would be remiss if I didn't try to say something at the beginning of this podcast that would acknowledge or address what's happening in my city, in our city. I don't really quite still know what to say. I think there's still quite a lot that is coming out, and there's still a lot of developments pertaining to the George Floyd case that we'll see. Essentially, I'm not going to talk about the specifics or hypotheticals of what happened in that case, but I do want to say that it makes me very sad that this human being was killed like an animal, that all of this. For as much as I love Minneapolis, it is a city beset with some of the worst racial disparities in the entire country. And that's really become apparent in how people are reacting. And there's always, I think, something. I mean, we saw it a few years ago with in Baltimore with Freddie Gray after his kill, after his murder, and just what happened in Baltimore. And I lived in Westminster, Maryland, several miles outside of Baltimore for about 2 years. So there was, there was some component of that hitting home, but it doesn't compare to this. It doesn't compare to watching, video footage, on in South Minneapolis and places I know. And you see, for example, like a little girl having to have liquid poured in her eyes because she's been hit with tear gas, standing right outside of Moon Palace Books. I can't tell you how many times I've been to Moon Palace Books. It's right up the street from the Trilon Cinema. The Trilon Cinema is, for if you haven't been there, one of the finest independent repertory cinemas in the country, as far as I'm concerned. They're a wonderful group of people, and for me, there's something about that particular pocket of South Minneapolis where kind of the nexus, right to the south of the police station. Ironically, I think that's what makes it so interesting is that there's these little pockets of local businesses and independent venues that are supporting the arts and supporting an expansion of an ongoing dialogue, and they're nestled right next to a place that has become the major site of a firestorm of controversy. An eruption of violence and a target of anger, of righteous anger, really. I don't really know quite what to say, other than thinking about this, just this sort of meeting point between sites of art providing a cultural dialectic, with social and political upheaval is something that I think, though the context is different, Nevertheless, I think that there, I my, it's our hope really that there are some lessons to still be gained from some of the stories from May 68, from that month, from that moment in history. And the one component that's still, I think, resonant is, I think is that was coined, the phrase that was coined then that's still resonant today, that was repurposed by Thomas Pynchon for Inherent Vice, and which was kept in the film during the end credits, is "Under the paving stones, the beach." We hope you enjoy our podcast. Stay safe, be well, and we love you, Minneapolis. Everybody, this is Alex Cooey here, wishing you all a nice day. Hope you're doing well, staying safe and healthy. And we're here on another episode of Cooey Films, speaking with Nick Cooey over in jolly old England. How you doing, Nick?
Doing pretty good, Alex. Doing pretty good. You know, it's the weather's nice here in England. The sun's shining. No Boris Johnson in sight, so I really cannot complain.
Well, that's good. I mean, well, I thought I heard there were reports of him lurking around in the woods. Or was that Bigfoot?
Well, I'm not sure what the British equivalent of Bigfoot would be, but actually, I mean, it is interesting that some people have been out and about, you know, in Hyde Park, staging some protests. You know, we don't have. I know we're going to be talking about protests at today's episode of this podcast, which is why I thought it might be pertinent to open it by just referencing one form of political demonstration that is not something that's worth emulating 50 years later.
Yes, you got that. I agree with you completely. But before we get into the politics, I just want to ask first, have you been seeing any good movies lately?
You know, yeah, I have been seeing, you know, it's been an interesting week for me because, you know, in class, for example, we were talking about futurism and the postmodern in relation to CGI. So, of course, we watched this avant-garde art house classic that's nearly 30 years old called Terminator 2. And maybe you've heard of it. I don't know.
Maybe, you know, I'm not sure. Doesn't it feature some machismo Austrian man?
It's got a really famous line in Spanish, but, you know, which was very progressive for 1991. I have to admit, but
oh yeah, you know, Boys in the Hood, I imagine, has got nothing on this.
Oh, in terms of progressive politics, no, God no. But yeah, you know, it was kind of interesting rewatching Terminator 2. I mean, I've seen some new movies since then, but like, you know, coming back to Terminator, you know, in an academic setting, it was kind of interesting when we started. You know, our professor would just simply said to us, you know, like try to. You kind of enter this movie, like try to kind of not bear so much in mind that you already had when, or like try to go into it as if you were somebody in 1991 first watching this movie. And I mean, for the most part, like I was able to do that, but like this thought kind of occurred to me, which is, I mean, for those who haven't seen it, I mean, for how much, I don't know, when was the last time you saw Terminator 2?
Oh God. I would say a long time ago, 15 years ago, maybe, you know, 10 to 15.
Okay. But you remember like the scene where, or not the scene, just the whole bit where John Connor tells the Terminator, like, you can't kill somebody. He's like, why? You just can't. Why? And so there's that whole kind of thing where like the second half of the movie, like he doesn't kill anybody. But what's interesting to me, what I found was interesting was that, so it's kind of this sort of, it's trying to kind of contend with this sort of moral complexity of defense, but then not killing anybody. And what does it mean to really take a life? And like, and in that respect, like that's so unusual in a lot of action movies, especially, you know, the action films of like Zack Snyder or Michael Bay, where they relish wanton destruction, but with no regard.
I was gonna say, oh, come on. If a Superman can kill people, so can this guy.
Right? Yeah, I mean that's what's just so bizarre about the whole thing too. But here's the thing, like I was sort of like intending, like on the one hand, I think it's really interesting that James Cameron is trying to kind of give sort of a sense of weight to the violence in this action, what is ostensibly a big budget action spectacle. But on the other hand, is he also not having his cake and eating it too? In like scenes where like the T-100 is at that office building with John and Sarah Connor and the guy who makes the microprocessor, which, you know, essentially makes Skynet. I don't know how much you remember about that, but like there's,
Yeah, I remember he croaks.
yeah, he croaks and like the building explodes and like, but there's, you know, there's that whole part where there's the police outside and, you know, Schwarzenegger, blows them away. And like right before though, he like goes to like fire on them, like, John Connor says, he's like, hey, you can't kill anybody, remember? And then he, you know, turns to him and says in his very Schwarzeneggerian, trust me. And like, and to me, like, it felt almost like what we witnessed then following that, where he's like shooting all these cop cars and he steals a police van and he crashes through a building and nearly hits a bunch of people. It's like, it's almost like this condoned mode of destruction, you know? Like, it's like trying to let the audience off the hook as well.
Well, that's Cameron speaking to the audience. That's Cameron saying, trust me.
Yeah, I think it is actually. I think you're onto something. I do think it is James Cameron very much winking at the audience and going like, you know, don't feel bad about watching this guy wreck all this property and like, you know, he's not killing anybody. And so that gives us, you know, the okay to really relish in the carnage that he, you know, sort of he lays out before us. You know, I don't want to poo-poo Terminator 2 so much, but I thought it was just a really interesting kind of moral quandary to consider in a film that tries to kind of establish something of a moral ambivalence or ambiguity. I don't know. That's my thought on the matter, I guess.
Well, I think you're onto something. I mean, it's like James Cameron would probably go, "Yeah, just don't think about this. Go along with it. Otherwise, I'm gonna be in deep doo-doo for the stuff I'll show you in my next movie, True Lies." Ugh.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. Like, James Cameron has always had problematic elements. And yeah, I think his two subsequent movies, True Lies and Titanic, are much more problematic than Terminator 2, I would argue.
Now, Avatar, that's flawless. And I cannot wait to see his four sequels.
You know, I think James Cameron can't wait to see his four sequels either. I think he just forgot that James Cameron's making them.
Well, he's so rich, he can make anything he wants to, even if nobody will see it.
Yeah. But my hope is that whether you agree with me or not, you know, hopefully this will inspire some of you guys to check out Terminator 2 again. It's the perfect quarantine movie.
Yeah, I like to see it again. If for nothing else, also like some of it's the groundbreaking use of special effects, especially for 1991. Yeah, I would like to revisit that picture again. But I saw
Well,
something.
I just wanted to say really quick, you know, two things that one, the special effects, you know, for 1991, like I think they've aged pretty well, all things considering. And I do admire the way that the film utilizes CGI, but then tries to seamlessly bridge that with some practical effects. So I think in that way, like the film is a fairly sophisticated example of special effects. But one last little thing I wanted to say, there's a moment. I will say, like, the other anachronistic moment I had from the while watching the film was just the scene where Sarah Connor, if you remember, she's in that insane asylum in the first half of the movie, and then she kind of breaks out from her room and she's trying to escape, and then, you know, she goes up to the doctor, kind of that asshole, and she pretty much, I don't know if you remember this, but she like puts a syringe full of cleaner fluid, you know, she fills it with cleaner fluid and she puts it in his neck, and then she threatens to like pump him full of it. You know, like, unless she, like, the guards let her out of the store. And I just remember thinking to myself, ah, oh, he's gonna be fine.
Well, I think somebody actually just posted a meme of that moment you were talking about.
Really? Oh my God, I'm so glad I'm not the only one who thought that. What about you, Alex? What's a good movie that you've seen or rewatched lately?
Well, actually, this is not a film I rewatched per se, but actually, it was a new film I just saw. And it was actually part of because here in Minnesota, we have the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival going on this year. But of course, due to the COVID-19, it is being held online. So people who want to watch the movies are watching them through their computers at home, which I think is a good call, even though. Today it's the 18th, so the governor's stay-at-home order has just been lifted. But I'm not going to be going out anytime soon, and I'm glad they're not doing that. But one of the movies I saw actually was a film called Coup 53, which I believe you also saw at the London Film Festival last fall. Am I correct?
I did indeed, yeah.
Yeah, I saw that. And then afterwards, I actually got I watched a Q&A with the film's director, as well as co-writer and editor, the legendary Walter Murch.
So what did you well, for people who don't know it's can you explain a little bit of what the film is about?
Yeah, gladly. It's basically about it chronicles the history of in 1953. When the United Kingdom and the United States governments essentially overthrew Iran's first democratically elected prime minister, whose name is Mohammad Mossadegh, and how he was replaced by the Shah. So basically, it goes through all these details where you see it gives you the historical context and also see, like, with all the tension and that came, like, when Mohammad first came into the prime minister's seat and how. His position was a little bit delicate and fragile, and how because he was trying to nationalize the country's oil, the governments of US and UK were against that because they had lots of corporations that were that had oil coming from Iran, and how the at the end how they were able to successfully overthrow him and the long-term ramifications of that on not only Iran itself, but its relationships with those countries as well, with our country and the UK, and as well as the United States relationship with other Middle Eastern countries.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what's interesting about the film too is that it illustrates, I think, just the sheer difficulty it is there is in terms of really acquiring information about this coup, you know, of the coup that ousted Mossadegh, and in terms of just the amount of not even just well, there. I mean, so what's interesting about the film is too, like, because it's the director. He's going around, and I'm going to try to remember his name, Taghi Amirani.
Yeah, that's it. Taghi Amirani.
So Amirani is he's going around. He's trying to kind of delve through the archives and really uncover a lot of information. And there's of course this multi-part documentary series that was made in the UK about Britain and its relationship with colonies. And then of course he stumbles upon a lot of redacted transcripts from a particular figure named Norman Derbyshire, who, according to him, and according to his, the argument the film kind of postulates is that Derbyshire had a pretty critical role in terms of really, if not as a as an architect of the coup, certainly as one who helped see it through when there was a moment even where it seemed like the US was like, well, okay, like, these guys, they have their democratically elected prime minister. We're out of here. And even the UK, the Brits were kind of worried about it. But this guy was like, no, let's stick around. Let's keep focusing on this. And it, I mean, I'm not going to give it away, but I will say what's interesting too about the way that the film presents Derbyshire is because since there's no footage of him that exists, you know, since the British government, for reasons of national security, they've kept the transcripts, but they deleted the am I correct in saying that they deleted or it's just hidden away somewhere?
Well, what's interesting is that initially, like, in the miniseries program is called End of Empire, by the way, it came out in 85. And initially, when they were looking at the transcripts, they, yeah, like, saw when it came to this Norman Derbyshire, all these, like, his name was redacted and all his lines were essentially, like, cut out. And, like, literally, it's like somebody took a pair of scissors and cut out these lines. But then they found another copy of the transcript, which had his name and the lines intact, but, like you said, they couldn't find the footage. So, what's interesting is, as a means of like visualizing his statements and testimonies, they actually get a well-renowned British actor, Ray Fiennes, to say the lines and to record cameras as if he's playing this character, as if he's the one being interviewed.
It's a very interesting gambit, but I think it's something that I think like on several circumstances I would be a little more annoyed with, but I think it works in the context of the film in terms of the way that it tries to kind of peel back layers of this whole story to kind of uncover the truth, but then also sort of saying, well, if we're not able to kind of completely demystify this, at least we can try to still have some sort of element of the truth in terms of the transcript from his conversations. And, no, it's a really interesting documentary. I really liked it a lot. And I think, I'm not sure if it's what the distribution rights are looking like in the US. I don't think it's streaming here in the UK. I could be wrong. If I am wrong, I'd be very happy to hear that I'm wrong. But if you can find it, I think it's definitely worth tracking down because I think it's a really interesting kind of crash course on that particular historical moment. That's something that, you know, is not really prevalent in dominant discourse in either the States or Britain, but especially Britain. You know, because Britain, that's the other thing too, is that there has been kind of this hesitance to really talk about a lot of the past and their involvement with dismantling some of these democratically elected nations in the 20th century. And it's a sticky situation, you know, to peel back and to talk about, but it's something that I think you'd agree with me that it's still a very relevant topic and it's a necessary one that we should be discussing.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, and I really liked the film as well. I mean, not just connecting to it on a personal level, because for those who may not know about us, our father is from Iran, we have family from Iran, so there's that familial connection. And actually, I don't know if you knew this, Nick, but actually, when I mentioned about this documentary to our father the other day, he actually told me that our grandfather was arrested by the Shah.
I did know that, yeah. Yeah, I remember hearing that story, and it was kind of funny. I actually got into a conversation last fall. We had at the school here, we had Chris Morris, who directed Three Lions, and he has his new film, which is The Day Shall Come. And he was there talking about the film after a screening of The Day Shall Come, and he was mentioning kind of his interest in the Iranian coup as maybe like a topic for a miniseries. So afterwards, I actually went up to him, and I was like, hey, you know, I kind of heard what she was saying, like, I'm really interested in that. And we kind of talked about it a little bit and I was like, oh, because I'm Iranian, like, or my family on my dad's side is Iranian. And I did tell him that our grandfather was, you know, arrested, nearly executed by the Shah. And he was like, wow, that's super interesting. But like, so was he a freedom fighter? Was he like duplicitous? You know, was he, you know, like, well, and I was like, I didn't get into too much details about it because, A, I was like, well, I'd like to, you know, keep privacy for my family, but also B, like in terms of the specificity, I wasn't able to say like, well, he was a freedom fighter, or like, or, oh, he was a conscientious objector, you know, but it's also one of those things where I just kind of realized like that there's still a lot of, in terms of just personal history, a lot that I'd still like to work at because, yeah, it means a lot to both you and me on a personal level. And it's something that resonates still. And it's something that, you know, I mean, the whole notion that, you know, that our grandfather was spared from an execution, you know, but only just in the nick of time is, as our dad likes to tell it, you know, I mean, if that weren't the case, then you and I would not be here talking about this. And probably you, dear listener, would be listening to some other twin cinema related podcast.
Yeah, so a couple of, as Pierre Bradshaw might eloquently put it, cinema brats. I don't think Coup 53 has a U.S. distributor yet as of now, but they're looking for one, of course, and they're always looking to spread the word. So, you know, go to the Minneapolis Film Society website, look into it, and check it out. I think it's very important because you talk about, also, it's not just the United Kingdom, but I think the United States, too, has a problem with acknowledging their involvement in the overthrow of these democratically elected governments, and how the film argues that the events in Iran of 53 kind of sort of became a domino effect and inspired them to do the same thing with other nations such as Guatemala or Chile, or they tried doing it with Castro and so on and so forth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I mean, I think it's really perfect that you're talking a little bit about tumultuous 20th century political history. Because like I was saying earlier, we're kind of wanting to, that's going to be the kind of the focus of what we're talking about today. And the reason we were talking about it today was not really because we're like, oh, let's do a political podcast. Let's rustle some jimmies, as the kids say. Do the kids even still say that? Rustle some jimmies. Maybe I'm 10 years behind on my memes. To now, though, the whole impetus for this conversation was because today, so the day that we're recording this, today is May the 17th. It's a Sunday. And, on a typical day like this, time of the year, a lot of people would be congregated in the south of France in Cannes, watching movies. And, that is certainly not happening this year. But it's not the only time that this hasn't happened. As I'm sure many of you know, or many of you may be kind of familiar with on a cursory level, the last time the festival had to be canceled or postponed was May of 1968. And so that's kind of what we're going to be sort of talking about. And before we kind of go into it, what did you know about May of 68 before we started really prepping for this podcast, Alex?
Well, I have to be honest, I didn't quite know a lot. I didn't know a lot of the specifics or details. I just knew that there had been riots and there was kind of an eruption that went on during that time period. So I was faintly aware that the festival was canceled, because of it. Though then I didn't realize also it was midway through. But yeah, I didn't really know a whole lot. What about you?
I mean, before this podcast, I will say that I had the advantage of I'm going to grad school and I've been reading some stuff, but like even a year ago, I learned a lot of new things about it that I hadn't known before. So I definitely, within a relatively recent span of time, I wouldn't, I think that we're going to try to cover within our own purview, as we're not historians necessarily, but I do think we're going to try to cover as much as we can in terms of illustrating some of the context surrounding what happened in that month of May. And the one major thing that I had no idea about was something that has been referred to as the Langlois affair. And the Langlois affair, to explain, we have to, I mean, I think to really begin with this story, we have to start with one person, which is Henri Langlois. Now, Henri Langlois, the name might ring a bell with some of you cinephiles or cineasts listening to this podcast, but for the others who are not as familiar with him, Henri Langlois was the co-founder of the Cinémathèque Française, along with Georges Franju. They founded in 1936, I want to say, if I'm remembering correctly. And then essentially, Langlois really became one of the first major film archivists in history. I mean, certainly one of the most revered, because he, with his, I mean, he had his whole philosophy. I mean, this is a guy who really was about collecting. He was a collector, almost to the point that it could be to the point of being, one could see him as a hoarder, really, of films, but he just consistently cull together all these film prints, and he would show films in a very clandestine manner to other people in the resistance during the Second World War. And I mean, one thing that was interesting, one little tidbit that I heard was that, and this is also kind of related, I think, with the occupying force in France from that time too, in terms of German occupation. But one thing I did think was interesting that was that, and it's not just because of Langlois, but it's also because of maybe some speculative notion about the Germans also trying to kind of preserve film for their own means. But in Paris, I want to say that by the end of the war, there were about 3,000 film prints that had survived, and from that, following the end of the war, Langlois was really able to establish a pretty solid foundation to just branch out and actually make a name for himself and to really begin to sort of extend his reach. I think the thing that's really interesting, the one thing that has to be kind of stressed about Henri Langlois in terms of how he went about acquiring film prints, is that you would have certain programmers or archivists like Ernest Lindgren or Iris Berry. And what they would do, of course, is they would be much more professional in terms of how they would acquire these prints. They would, navigate through the correct channels. They would, fill out the right forms. Langlois, though, what he would do, he would focus more on cultivating personal relationships with filmmakers. And that helped him kind of circumvent some of these more traditional approaches. And so the consequence of that was that because he was establishing personal relationships with people like Jean Renoir or Orson Welles or Joseph Losey, or Nicholas Ray, that had the effect of really granting the Cinematheque a pretty high reputation or high status by filmmakers within the international community, especially when compared to an archive that would be more intrinsically linked with the state. And yeah, essentially, Langlois put on screenings in a 50-seat theater at the original headquarters, which were located on Avenue de Messine. But the Cinémathèque transitioned to a 250-seat cinema in the mid-50s, and it was in 1963 that Langlois finally received increased support from the government, which allowed him to transition to the Palais de Chaillot. And that was a big deal. But the one thing that we have to talk about, like, even though Langlois, he was a hero to many, and he was very much revered in it, and I think, we have to give the man credit for what he did, because he was one of the first major film archivists, and because he was, like, collecting all of these films and preserving them, he was responsible for, I mean, for example, like, here in London, the first major Abel Gance retrospective was held because of him. Bunuel's L'Age d'Or was screened on 35 millimeter because he had a 35 millimeter print in his collection, along with Le Vampire and a couple of films by Eric von Stroheim. The complete print of Lola Montez by Max Ophüls was in his collection, and that was a film that, was nearly lost to time. So the man really did have a, I think he had a strong
Oh,
effect
yes.
on a lot of film preservation. But by that same token, he had his shortcomings.
Well, I mean, apart from his methods of preserving films, like he would keep film reels locked up in secret places that he told nobody about, and then the other places that were just unusual. Like, he even apparently kept film stock in his bathtub.
You never know. You never know if you're, on the John and you're like, well, guess I'll watch a Rue Mermillion film.
Or maybe if you all of a sudden are looking, you're on the John, and all of a sudden you're looking in the bathtub, and you look through the film stock, and you're like, "Oh, wait, I recognize this. This is in the realm of the senses."
That's a little early, but oh, that's terrible. I don't need to picture that. Ew. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, and he also not just inspired in terms of film preservation, an archive, but also, if it weren't for him, we probably wouldn't have had the French New Wave and that group of filmmakers that he inspired, like François Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard.
Yeah, no, I think that's, you're right, Alex. I mean, that's really, really critical to keep in mind, is that the Cinémathèque Française was this kind of holy site for Truffaut and Godard and Chabrol and Romare, Jacques Rivette, all these guys, from the Cahiers du Cinéma group, were going to the Cinémathèque and watching all of these movies. And that was such a formal foundation for their education as cinephiles and ultimately as filmmakers.
Yeah, but if he had some shortcomings, when I was doing my research on him, I knew that he had a bit of a tumultuous relationship with the government, and he apparently was allegedly quoted as saying, like, "Well, okay, I'm not going to necessarily like follow your guidelines, but just give me the money, and I to get the films."
Yeah, Langlois was, he was not, once the government, after 63, once the government started providing him more subsidies, he was, nevertheless, that did call for more accountability. And that was something that he was not really cool, like, or he was not comfortable with. And, you know, and already by this point, we had seen that Langlois had some mismanagement in terms of his bookkeeping. I mean, the most infamous example of this is actually on July 10th, 1959, there was this fire. Now, the cause of which is sort of, it's up for debate. Penelope Houston claims that it started because there were a bunch of film canisters left out in a courtyard, and a bunch of them were nitrate film prints.
Which, if you guys know nitrates, you don't leave a bunch of nitrate out in a courtyard on a sunny day.
Highly flammable, highly dangerous, and, you know, once it spreads, it's very difficult to contain it. But the point being, too, that there was not really an idea of how the fire started. And once this terrible fire, it was, one of the warehouses of the Cinematheque, after it was done, there was no way to really properly calculate the damage that had been done in terms of how many films were lost. And what was worse was that what is known is that quite a number of these films were actually, they didn't belong to the Cinémathèque Française. They belonged to other archives, and they were waiting transport to go back to those archives. So really, this was a huge blow to Langlois. Like, Langlois was furious, precisely because this was a huge blow to his reputation in an international setting with some of the other archives, you know, because now they're, you know, why would you want to, like, license a film print to this guy if he's just going to get all these prints, like, burnt up to a crisp? And that was actually, and not long after this fire, he actually left the FIAF, which is the International Federation of Film Archives, of which he was a founding member, but he did leave shortly after this fire. And I think that may be partially because he was wanting to try to navigate away from some more of the bureaucracy, maybe, or maybe because of his own trying to save face. You know, there's a little bit of speculation in terms of his motivations, because Langlois himself was a man who so carefully attempted to cultivate this projection of himself as this guy, you know, who would, like, walk around and he'd point out, you know, to bygone relics of the French Revolution, and he would say, yes, the revolution, it haunts me. I'm looking, he once said, I'm looking for a souvenir of the French Revolution. I am hunted by the revolution because it was the revolution of freedom.
Yeah. Oh, that pretty eloquent for a guy who also, you know, describing his position at the Cinémathèque in relation to filmmakers and about films, he said, well, you know, I just would present the films. It's like giving out food. I just give out food, food, food.
But that is very much his philosophy, too. It's like, it's just like, for Langlois, cinema was the smorgasbord to consume. Never, like, why would you have a film if you weren't going to watch it?
And what was interesting, too, was I remember seeing this in a little documentary featurette about him, but his choice of which films to project to which audiences, too, would be interesting. Like, sometimes, for instance, if he could see that an audience wasn't getting invested or involved in the movie they were watching, he'd stop maybe midway through. He's like, oh, okay, this is a stupid audience. I'll show you a stupid movie. You know, and he just played that one instead.
Right. I mean, he was very iconoclastic in that way, you know, which definitely you can see why that would have, why that would appeal to a lot of iconoclastic cinephiles and filmmakers. And by that same token, why it would really piss off the government. And that's kind of what happened, you know, like the government was trying to kind of negotiate with Langlois and work with him. And they found him very, very difficult to work with. So what happened was, because of his obstinacy, and because he was also very much spending money on, for example, you know, lavish galas to try and court film stars to come to these events so that, you know, they might be able to give prints at some point. You know, I mean, the man, for him, you know, he spared no expense. But the government, once they started providing more public subsidies for the Cinémathèque, they began having issues with that. So what happened was, they had kind of been discussing for a few months in late 1967, but on February 9th, 1968, this is an important date because on this day, the Executive Council of the Cinémathèque Française convened for a vote to remove Langlois from his post. Now, Truffaut and Godard were on the council, they refused to vote. They were absolutely furious at the notion of trying to remove him, so they just abstained from voting completely. But it was a futile gesture. The council ended up voting to remove Langlois, and he was removed from his post. And so the Minister of Arts, André Malraux, had Langlois replaced with Pierre Barbin. And his previous experience was primarily working with smaller festivals at Tours and Annecy. And so you would think, well, that's a shame. That should be the end of the story. And far from it. In fact, the government was anticipating, of course, some blowback, but the amount of resistance and the outcry following Langlois' dismissal was something that they could not have anticipated. It was just enormous. They began to receive all of these, this signed petition from a lot of filmmakers from all over the world. And that included Roberto Rossellini, Pier Paolo Pasolini, Fritz Lang, Charlie Chaplin. They all were throwing their support with
Stanley Kubrick.
Kubrick, yeah, yeah. Joseph Losey, Nick Ray. They all were throwing their support behind Langlois. And they said, look, like, we're supporting him, and you do not have our permission to screen our films. So then you have that as well. And that, you combine that with, of course, with Godard and Truffaut and Lelouch and the other guys, they were protesting outside of the new location of the Cinémathèque, the Palais de Chaillot. There were a couple of dates. There was the 12th of February that they were protesting outside. But then the big one, kind of the one that's more sort of famous, is the 14th of February, because that was when the police came and things devolved into a big tussle. You know, people got kicked around, there were arrests made, but they were, and actually, this is something that I didn't know, and it doesn't surprise me in the slightest, that a couple of days after this, the conflict with the police on the 14th of February, Godard was at this press conference, and he was encouraging audiences, if they were going to go to the Cinémathèque Française, he encouraged them to partake in what he called perpetual sabotage. And this included, quote, discreetly slash the seats with a razor blade, throw ink pots at the screen, just to name a couple.
Actually, that sounds like the kinds of things he would do to his own movies and then project them to an audience.
Well, I mean, this is the man also, let's not forget, who, you know, nearly 20 years after this happened, got hit in the face with the custard cream pie but yes. That's for another con podcast. But needless to say, they were victorious, and, you know, the kind of the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of Langlois' favor was that was through the intervention of a man named Frederick Gronich. And Gronich was the official representative of the Motion Pictures Association of America, the MPAA, in Paris at the time. And he demanded to Malraux that, on behalf of the studios, that the Cinémathèque return the prints that which had been submitted to the Cinémathèque back to the studios. And that was, of course, a huge, huge threat to what the Cinémathèque could really do. I mean, that was their whole reputation, having access to all of these films. And once they don't have that, then they've really got nothing. Now, whether this demand was born from a sense of solidarity with Langlois, whether Gronich was helping the studios sort of look out for their own personal interests, that's not entirely easy to discern. But in any case, his demand ultimately caused Malraux to cave and reinstate Langlois back to his former post on the 22nd of April. Though it's important to note that even though Langlois got his job back, the government funding, which was previously promised to the Cinémathèque, was rescinded, and Langlois lost his government salary. And that's just the beginning of our story.
Well, and you keep in mind, like, while all that was going on, the country of France itself...
France was not having a great time.
No, it wasn't a great year for the government of France in the year of 68.
De Gaulle was having a real bummer of a year, let me tell you.
Yeah, he was. And because around that time period, while all that was going on, you have, like, there was already tensions with the working class, the proletariat, who were complaining because of how they felt they wanted to have better wages and working rights. And also you have the students friends who were getting into left-wing politics and also interested in anarchist politics as well. They were protesting against the Vietnam War, and there were some instances which had a pretty significant effect on the country. Like on the 22nd of March, over 150 students had occupied an administration building at the Paris University at Nanterre, and they met there so they could talk about some of their demands that they felt needed to happen. They're asking the government for them, like they wanted to have the release of colleagues arrested shortly before, and it was 4 days prior because I believe it was of a bomb incident, right?
Well, yeah, so what happened was, I mean, so a little context. I mean, you're right, absolutely, that there was, because there was a lot happening politically in France, and it's a lot that, scholars and historians have really gone into some great detail. But essentially what had been happening through the 60s was, of course, you had at the beginning of the 1960s still very much France still kind of entrenched in the Algerian War. And there was a lot of controversy around that, of course, in terms of what was happening there, in terms of the French colonial presence in that region, the really brutal tactics undertaken in that conflict on both sides, really. And that's something that really was sort of it was actually a topic of discussion among some of the intelligentsia. Specifically, one example is Godard's second film, Le Petit Soldat, The Little Soldier. It was shot and finished in 1961, and it was very much about Algeria, the attempted coup the French tried to stage in 1958. But needless to say, it was very controversial, and actually the film was prohibited from screening in for 2 years until January of 1963. So it ended up not really being Godard's second released film, but actually his fourth released film. And the thing is, this was not an isolated incident in terms of just the French censors banning work or delaying their release. Of course, I mean, this had happened even like with non-French films, like Paths of Glory was famously banned for nearly 20 years because of its depiction of the French military in World War I. But more in relation to the context of the French filmmaking community, there was one interesting instance I think that's really good to note is Jacques Rivette, his second film, which is called La Religieuse, The Nun, from 1965. And that was very much, it has Anna Karina in it. It has her joining a convent as a nun. And it was greeted with kind of this firestorm of controversy, primarily because it's a film that's sort of engaging in sort of the complex moral ambivalence of figures of authority within the Catholic Church. And what's interesting is that even though de Gaulle was not explicitly wanting to ban this film, but I think it's interesting to know that de Gaulle was raised in a devoutly Catholic upbringing. And so you had this still like a this kind of a puritanical sensibility in France, really from the perspective of the government and the way they would react to films like that, and of course the Battle of Algiers. But then while that was happening, you had this school of thought that was really, you've already touched upon some of it, Alex, in terms of, Maoist extremist ideology or, Trotskyism. But then even in terms of French thinkers like Guy Debord, he's writing about, society is spectacle and spectacle is surveillance, there's also Roland Barthes, who's talking very much about the notion of cinema and of the text. And what does a text really mean when divorced from the identity of the author? Of course, and then you have Jean-Paul Sartre, who's talking about sex and philosophy. And so I mean, it's really kind of this confluence of modernist thinking that's contrasting to this modernist thinking that's also very much engaging with a history of colonialism. So you have France leaving Algeria, but there's still the kind of resentment about the Algerian War, in the mid-60s. And France is also still involved in Vietnam. So it seems like that there's this cyclical perpetuation of what were perceived as outdated colonialist practices symptomatic of a consumerist society. And that was really, you know, there was kind of this sense, again, like there was a sense of like resistance fomenting, but it really wasn't quite, I don't think the French government certainly didn't quite realize how big that was until 1968. And really kind of the first major thing, it's important to note that kind of the first major kind of political step that was taken was something called the February Declaration. And that did take place in February 68. So the same month that Langlois lost his post, there was the Communist Party and the Socialist Party in France, and they issued this declaration. And essentially what they were hoping to accomplish with this was simply saying, look, like, we want to propose something which will, you know, strengthen a leftist coalition in this country. We want to, these were discussions that had been taking place for about 8 months, but also, you know, there was a sense of a leftist uprising in France in 1965. Here's an example. In 1965, in the general election, François Mitterrand, who was the candidate for the Federation of the Democratic and Socialist Left Party, or the FGDS, I promise I'm going to keep the acronyms to a minimum during this podcast, because I know that those are confusing, but François Mitterrand, he ran against de Gaulle in the general election. Now, he lost, but he won 45% of the popular vote. Now, that's nothing to sneeze at. That's a pretty significant portion of the population that's saying, you know, like, maybe we need something that's not so de Gaulle at this moment. And I think there's actually a really interesting, I think Arthur Mandel, he wrote this article in 1969, the year after the May 68 movements. And he was saying that what, you know, the communists and the socialist parties in France were doing was kind of, with their February Declaration, they were fomenting, in his words, quote, for the first time in decades, the real possibility of another popular front government, unquote. And of course, the front government being from 36 to 38, somewhere like right there at the onset of the second, or in the midst of the Second World War. There was a lot of potential, and a lot of promise in formulating an alternate or slightly deviating from some of the components of French society that really were not fully equitable.
Yeah, and
What were you going to say?
I was just going to say, and so then all the, you know, you can see some of these ideologies and philosophies were kind of permeating over into this new climate, shaping this new climate in France, because then you have on March 22nd, you know, the students making demands such as
One thing I wanted to say, because we forgot to contextualize this. So what happened was, during the February 14th demonstrations, a lot of the students were protesting as well. It was an easy target to come to this thing that was very much critical of the government. And they thought, you know, might as well seize upon this opportunity and this momentum. And one of the people that was at the 14th demonstrations that culminated in the police conflict was Daniel Marcon Bendy. And he kind of became this sort of infamous figure in the French press. He was called Danny LaRouche. And that's actually exactly why I wanted to preface that, because, you know, Combendy, he ended up, first I want to say that also, like, his whole, I mean, the way that really the opposition painted him was really, quite frankly, it got to some point where it was very, very ugly. Like, there were a lot of accusations, like, kind of, people were starting to sort of bring into his whole, you know, Jewish heritage. Yeah, and they were calling him, like, Combendi Dachau. You know, it was some ugly stuff, but he was involved with...
I also suspect they didn't just call him Denis Le Rouge because he had his hair dyed red.
No, that would be a correct assumption. It was because he was... very much firmly a leftist, and he was one of the most notable figures in the March 22nd demonstrations. And like you said, Alex, what had happened was on the 18th, there were some bombs that had been planted in several Parisian banks or just business offices. So like Chase Manhattan Bank, Bank of America, Transworld Airlines, they all had bombs that were detonated there by radical students. Some of these students were discovered and they were arrested. And of course, there was also another demonstration that was taking place at the American Express offices on the 20th of March, but the 22nd was really a big watershed moment. It was when there was this large mixture of students, but then you also had Trotskyists, you had intellectuals, and you had artists occupying the school building.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, and I, like I was saying, you know, I kind of wonder if Jean-Paul Sartre's musings on sexuality or why, I wonder if they're what inspired the students to demand the grant them permission to be able to like fraternize and socialize with women in girls' dormitories.
Well, I mean, I can't speak to that for certain, but I do know that Jean-Paul Sartre was actually a visible figure later on in May. Like during the mass demonstrations, he was there marching along with a lot of the other demonstrators, and he was very much in support of, political action and in terms of political violent action. So it would not surprise me if there was a little bit of thought that was influencing these students here.
That wouldn't surprise me either, which I guess, I think that's a good opportunity for us to, you then fast forward to early May, you know, we have May 2nd, universities closed down, like the University of Paris, which is now Paris Nanterre University. And then the following day, students at the Sorbonne campus of the University of Paris, which is just known as Sorbonne University today, they came together and they actually demonstrated in the Latin Quarter. And this became a pretty huge, you know, pretty big. There were more than 20,000 students, teachers, and supporters that marched towards the Sorbonne. And then eventually they had clashes with the police, and which resulted also in, on May 10th, we had the barricades. Am I correct?
Well. So what happened was, I mean, we're jumping around a little bit, but you're right. The 2nd of May and the 3rd of May, really, like that was when things were really starting to really coalesce in terms of students' political mobility. There was, during that time, one thing that's important to note is that there were a number of demands that a lot of these young people, a lot of these teachers were issuing. They asked that criminal charges were dropped against their fellow students, that the police would leave the university, the authorities would reopen both Nanterre and the Sorbonne. But that didn't happen. There was just the instead of a de-escalation, really, the police continued to occupy the Sorbonne. And the 10th of May was kind of, among certain press junkets, referred to as the Night of the Barricades. And that was when this enormous crowd congregated on the Rive Gauche. And there was this major, huge eruption of violence around 2:15 in the morning, when these negotiations between the crowd and the police just kind of floundered.
And there were apparently like 30,000 people that took to the streets that night.
Yeah. To me, that's so incredible, is that you've gone from the 22nd of March to like 150 students occupying a school building. And over the course of nearly 2 months, it's really ballooned to 30,000.
When that's not even the maximum of people that would end up going on strike and revolting.
Oh no! Oh no! No no! No 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 no! No, it was that was just the tip of the iceberg, really. But it really just shows you, I think, that by that point, by the night of the barricade, you know, that there was a lot of solidarity that was being expressed and felt with these students. And, you know, and that was again because of the demands they were wanting to make. And I think, and a lot of, leftist, individuals and thinkers, really had sympathy with them. And also because that there was really just sort of what was frankly kind of a heavy-handed or kind of very overly blunt reaction from the government. Like, it was just sort of like, there was kind of this sense of, I mean, there was not, I would say that it was not even a little bit of a condescension, you know, it was just very much greeting these protesters with suppression. And even it got so bad to the point that on the 10th of May, that there was just this distrust now being sown of the police. Like, there were these allegations that the cops had planted some narcs, you know, in the crowd to just sort of incite violence and burn cars and throw Molotov cocktails. So really there was just this complete disintegrate, like whatever sort of faith the students had in the government to negotiate, it was, by this point, it was nearly gone. And so that made things, and so things got even worse, you know, because then on the 13th, just 3 days later, then you have a bunch of workers, who are joining, the support of the students there and of these, of the left. And so what they're to have, for example, the Confédération Générale du Travail, or the CGT, the Force Ouvrière, the CGTFO, they were calling for a 1 day general strike at first, but, you know, it's something that it ended up going on for a little longer than that. And what's interesting to me is that with these unions, it wasn't actually the unions that were trying to set these off. These were a collective of people within these unions who were just banding together and just discounting the authority of their union leaders to say, you know what, like, we need to show some sign of solidarity here. And there were these attempts at concessions with them as well. For example, the trade union leadership attempted to sort of negotiate several terms by offering a 35% increase in the minimum wage, 7% wage increase for other workers, half normal pay for the time on strike with the major employers associations. And the workers pretty much unanimously said to this, fuck you. I can tell you what you can do with these demands. And so this is a situation that was really rapidly getting out of control. It was something. Now, at this point, you know, you had general strikes, you had factories closing, you had transportation that was closing, UNEF Student Union and CFDT Trade Union were holding a joint rally at Charlottetown Stadium. It was chaos, but it was invigorating chaos, you know, because you still had a lot of division between the communists and the socialists, you know, in terms of a lot of party infighting going on. But there was this, there was very much this feeling that civil war could very feasibly break out, or a revolution could happen.
So with keeping all that in mind, you can see how this would affect the Cannes Film Festival as it was going on that year. Actually, the Night of the Barricades, that was the opening night of the festival in which they decided to screen a 70mm print of Gone with the Wind. Not sure if that's...
I mean, if there's nothing... To me, that's such a... That speaks to this real schism between, like what I was even talking about in terms of, like, kind of this more conservative, puritanical, you know, ideology clashing really with this, really, this surge of leftist thinking. Like, what more kind of a, you know, asynchronous film could you show than Gone with the Wind? There's something really interesting about on the 10th of May. You know, by that point, there is kind of this question, like, who in their right mind would want to just sit down at this point and just watch movies? And of course, we had some very, very heated debates at the festival, you know, while some films were showing.
Yeah. And, there's debates even amongst the jury. I know there are people that are questioning amongst each other, like, should we continue with the festival? Should we cancel it? And some people, like Jean-Luc Godard, felt they could really take the opportunity to take a stand and to, you know, to try to make a stance with the people of France. And it's interesting because other people, like Roman Polanski, who was also a jury member that year, he felt that that if the festival were to go on, no one would really notice.
Right. And what's interesting, too, about, you know, with some, like at one point also like Polanski himself, like even years later, he was very critical of what was happening at the festival while, you know, while he was on the jury, because he felt, you know, that it was very much kind of a replication of communist policies that he witnessed in Poland. He even, you know, he asked, reportedly, he also was like, well, we know very much what the effects of communism is like, right? You know, Milos, and he's talking to Milos Forman, you know, who was there that year with the Fireman's Ball. And so you do have kind of this feeling of like, well, what is it going to matter that, you know, we have this festival going on? But then there was this very much also this counter argument that Truffaut was making, you know, of just like, well, we have this festival going on, or like, you know, you have the news, like violent protests and people getting brutally beaten by the police. And, you know, you open the newspaper and you just see, oh, Cannes Film Festival, like no one's going to give a like, that's not going to matter, like, to people to know about that. So we need to show, we need to stand up and express real, true solidarity with the students and the workers during this time to show that, you know, I mean, as Godard very famously and perhaps not so diplomatically yelled at the crowd, you know, you're just talking about camera setups and dolly shots. We're talking, you know, and you're just a bunch of idiots.
Yeah. But, you know, it's funny enough, I think a lot of people are using the term idiots around because actually there was a figure in France who would also become a future president, François Mitterrand. He actually referred to the students as a bunch of Catholic kids revolting against their parents, and he called them idiots. So that term seems...
Well, see, but that's what's interesting. No, but here's... You've just mentioned again, you just talked about Mitterrand, mm-hmm. you know, who I just mentioned, you know, if you recall, mm-hmm. like that he won the, he almost won the 65 election.
Yeah.
But even that attitude of like party politicians sort of downplaying, not maybe not downplaying, but certainly like having this sort of, diminishing of a lot of the young, protesters as well. It kind of spoke to kind of how things sort of eventually petered out because there was not really a concerted, officially sanctioned support of these protests, you know, by the end of May. The Communist Party was, you know, kind of removing itself from things. The Socialist Party was not really offering much of an official endorsement of anything. And of course, the police were staying consistently, they were staying on the students pretty consistently. So, Civil War did not break out. The revolution did not happen, but definitely by that time it did have an impact. And what had happened was that after how many days was it now? 3 days for Cannes?
Well, it was actually, the Cannes Film Festival started, like I said, on the 10th and, they actually decided to end it prematurely on the 19th of May, formally.
Oh, 9 days. 9 days, that's not bad.
Yeah, 9 days wasn't bad. So some movies did get screened, but then other filmmakers, like, as you mentioned, Milos Forman, and also Carlos Saura, Claude Lelouch, and Alain René, they asked for their films to not be screened in competition.
Right, because they did have competition films that were screening, or due to screen, and then they officially requested to withdraw them.
Yeah, actually, you know, I'll just say too, but because I think this is an incredible story, but Carlos Saura's film, Peppermint Frappe, the morning it was supposed to be screened for the press, he and his leading lady slash girlfriend at the time, Geraldine Chaplin, they actually came up and they demanded that to not start the projector. And they grabbed at the curtain so that the curtains couldn't be drawn back and the film couldn't be started. And helping them were Godard and Truffaut. And after, you know, a little physical altercation with the audience, then the screening was canceled. And actually, Truffaut, because of his actions that morning, was labeled persona non grata.
Hmm. And how long was Truffaut kind of banned from the festival?
Well, not for very long. He had another film of his, Day for Night, screened out of competition in 73. So, like, only 5 years later, maximum?
Yeah, It's interesting that, you know, just thinking about kind of, it really was sort of a circus and a spectacle. And of course, because of what we've been talking about, I mean, we've been spending, you know, quite some time just actually, you know, talking about the context surrounding the festival because there was so much happening. We've barely, of course, even scraped the surface here. But in all this discussion, it's kind of easy to forget, of course, that there were films that, as you said, some of them were screened. And I think, you know, you take a look at these films and you have to wonder, what are they saying about the moment in which they came out? And, you know, or like, how do you even begin to situate these films within Con 68, you know?
Or even some of the films that weren't screened that I think still you could argue would hold a lot of political and cultural relevance for the time period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, and, you know, what's interesting is that, I mean, I haven't seen all of the films that were due to be screened that year in Cannes. I mean, I think it's something that, thankfully some of these films, you know, they were very, very difficult to see for a long time. Like the Miklos Jungso double feature, or double bill. And those movies were The Confrontation and they were The Red and the White. They were both due to screen and competition, which I think is interesting that you had two movies from one filmmaker set to compete against himself. But those films have...
I don't know. That feels a little biased in his favor because it's like you have two films of yours that are in competition for the Golden Palm or the Grand Prize, as they said back in the day, called it back in the day, and everyone else has just one movie. I mean, that just sounds a little unfair.
Well, perhaps. Though I will say, in his defense, Miklos Jungso, he had some interesting... I mean, if you've never seen anything by him, I recommend checking out, like, if you're ever, like, were wondering, like, if you've, I feel like I want to say, has this ever happened to you? You're sitting down watching Sutton Tango, you know, you've got 4 hours in and you're like, well, man, Bellatar, he's so good at these long takes. Where does he get all this stuff? You know, you just watch Miklos Jungso, you know, like he was one of the seminal, Hungarian filmmakers of, well, really of his era. I mean, and thankfully, his work has been saved from obscurity thanks to the good work of distributors like Second Run here in the UK. But some of these other films that were kind of almost fading into obscurity, like Petulia and Charlie Bubbles by Albert Finney.
Yeah, and Petulia was by, you know, which is a drama by the usually comedic and quirky Richard Lester of Hard Day's Night fame.
Yeah, yeah, because Charlie Bubbles, I'd known that both these films were released by Indicator, and I knew, like, Charlie Bubbles, like, I had kind of heard of the name, and then I'd forgotten that Albert Finney directed it and starred in it.
I just forgot Albert Finney directed a movie.
I know. It's wild stuff. But, I don't know, Alex. I mean, you know, because you've seen, I mean, we've both seen some of these movies, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, from your impression, how do you kind of, do you, because I mean, sometimes some people like to, when they're writing about a write-up about Cannes, they're like, oh, this year at Cannes was about this particular thing. It was about, like, you know, there's always sort of a narrative that sort of surrounds, I mean, and it can, and that's the thing, like the Cannes Film Festival, it still like has narratives that are not necessarily contingent upon the films themselves, you know, but sometimes some people try to say like, oh, there's this unified feeling of like last year, for example, there were a lot of genre films that were in competition or in the director's fortnight. And I don't know, like what, from the stuff that you've seen, do you kind of sense any recurring threads or something that which might formulate what you could identify as a cohesive narrative?
Yeah, that's a good question. My initial impressions, when I think about movies I've seen that were scheduled to screen in Cannes, that year, you know, the terms I think of are like anarchic deconstruction. And that could be either like a deconstruction in terms of the form itself, like you have a film like Je t'aime by Alain René, which I'm convinced is a precursor to films like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and Inception, in that it goes on different levels of dream and also affects on memory and it sort of affects with narration. But then also about like a sort of... critique and attempt at dissolving of the sort of maybe conservative policies that dictate society. Whether it's like, I think in particular, I think of three films that I single out are Peppermint Frappe, The Fireman's Ball, and another film from a Czechoslovakian director. It was called A Report on the Party and Guests, which is directed by Jan Nemec, who is considered the enfant terrible of Czechoslovakia. And does what these movies have in common for me is that how they are like how they critique, like I said, their government sort of conservative leaning policies, admittedly to different degrees, like with Spain, with Peppermint Frappe, who's from Spain, during of Franco and during the Franco regime. And granted, though, this is during like his twilight years. But how it's interesting to see that because you have like these rigid views of what's considered like the ideal Spanish woman, and then you have this main character who becomes infatuated and lusts after this blonde girl, Geraldine Chaplin, who sometimes speaks with an American accent, and she's very flirty, she's very cheeky, and she knows English, and she doesn't seem to fit the role of like what was considered should be a standard Spanish woman, which is like the housewife, the dutiful lady. And actually, Chaplin also plays another female character in the movie who's like the main character, sort of like he's a doctor. And she is his assistant, and she's got like black hair. She's sort of meek and quiet, and it's no coincidence that these two characters are played by the same actress. That plays a crucial role in the film. That's not unlike Hitchcock's Vertigo, but I think it's very interesting the directions it takes with these characters and the way it ends, where it's like. The idea, it's like the it's like when you have these sort of oppressive viewpoints of like, okay, people are supposed to look like this or that, and with that, it's like you're oppressing these urges, which will then come out in volcanic form. And then, of course, in The Fireman's Ball by Milos Forman, it was a little controversial because the government had accused it of being a mockery against them. Even Forman was saying, well, I wasn't trying to go against the government per se. I just got the inspiration from going to see to a fireman's ball because he and his screenwriter, they were trying to make a follow-up to his Loves of a Blonde, which also got a lot of attention at the international circuit. And then they couldn't think of any ideas, so they went to this fireman's ball, and they just felt it was so inept and incompetent with the way the organization was held. They decided to make a movie out of that. And you have all these incidents and episodes where essentially, as the film progresses, you see this event where these members of this firemen's organization are trying to basically commemorate their honorary president who's turned 86. He's got cancer, though he doesn't know it, and they're trying to keep it a secret from him. So they're trying to hold the annual firemen's ball gathering. But as the event progresses, things just keep going wrong and wrong, and things just fall apart. And you see, mainly due to incompetent leadership. And it works on comedic, but also some very, very poignant levels, particularly through a sequence involving an old man's house that is engulfed in flames.
I mean, I just wanted to interject, Alex, because I haven't seen Peppermint Frappe, but from your description, it sounds like it's very much kind of it's a melodrama in that sense. Like you said, like it's about emotions that are very much repressed, neatly contained, and then they erupt. And even the notion of doubles and kind of this heightened sense of reality within Spain, it seems like it almost kind of like portends the La Movida movement, once Franco passed away and once Almodóvar, and his crew really kind of take the scene.
It's funny that you mentioned that because, yeah, many times when there are a few times when I was watching Peppermint Frappe, I was thinking of Almodóvar while watching it, and a little of like some of his works, particularly like I was thinking of The Skin I Live In.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Now I'm
I mean,
definitely.
it doesn't quite go that route, but maybe you can see sort of the connections of why I was thinking of that. But yeah, no, it's a very kind of it's a fascinating transitory work. Definitely worth checking out.
Well, and it is, like you said, it's occupying a very particular political moment where it's, filmmakers like Berlanga, with some of his movies, like The Executioner, like they're trying to kind of traverse around censorship as well, but to really sort of in, like through these indirect avenues, comment on, life in Franco's Spain. I mean, I think that's really, it is interesting, like the late 60s, it's just a few years away from his death. It's just kind of a matter of time. It's sort of a losing battle, in terms of censorship. But what I wanted to just say was that, I did see The Fireman's Ball last night, actually, on the Criterion Channel.
Oh, what'd you think of it?
Yeah, I had seen a couple of films from the Czech New Wave, but like it's something that I've really kind of gradually realized, like, they were making some really incredible movies during that time. I mean, and often, like, again, under some fairly extenuating circumstances and facing censorship, but also they would sometimes have incredibly simple, nearly allegorical tales, and yet imbue that with like this sense of invention, of intelligence, of wit, and of poignancy. And I think you're absolutely right. I think The Fireman's Ball is very much, it's a comedy. It's just a comedy about the growingly apparent absurdity of these guys and their fecklessness at really kind of gauging what the partygoers are feeling, what the guests are feeling, and it leads to some. And what I like about the film is that it doesn't overplay its hand in terms of comic effect, but it does still get some very funny, recognizably human comedy, I think, from just sort of the ineptitude of these people.
I mean, there is broad comedy in it, but it's like broad at just the right limit.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's not cartoonish.
No, though that's like, and then you get these things where just seeing it fall apart with anarchy, falling to anarchy, whether it's like the recurring joke, how it goes, like even from the beginning, like when one of the members is looking at the table and he's like, wait, where's the cake? It's disappeared. No, no, are you sure it was a cake? I thought it was something else.
Yeah, I thought it was a head of a cheese wheel, or Yeah, like you have those things like that, or like, I mean, I loved, like, cause there's this scene in the movie where they're trying to have this kind of like, this beauty contest.
Yeah, they call it like a Miss Fireman's Ball.
Miss Fireman, yeah, and their whole, just everything they go about it is like they're trying to recruit all these women to take part, and a lot of them are like, nah, we're good. And they're like, oh, they only have a couple, and then finally they get this group of women together. And it's just, this procession that they try to get going, it just goes spectacularly wrong.
Yeah, like even to the point when the moment when they're supposed to actually go on stage and the way that turns out.
Yeah, and it is kind of in the reason, and the way that kind of blends and that transitions into the fire scene. It's so, I think there's that humorous moment where they're like, oh, thank God, a fire.
Yeah. No, I really liked this movie. And, if you're a film fan, I think you'll love it. And I think it's interesting how, I think that was the last film he made in his native country before Forman went on to have a very prolific and successful career in the United States.
Well, actually, it's funny. Well, maybe not funny, but... I think there is very much a reason why, I mean, because that was his last movie in Czechoslovakia. It was because of the Prague Spring that was happening that year. And then like kind of when he was in France and he was wanting to go back. But then while he was in Cannes, then things were really beginning to escalate. There were Soviet tanks that were driving through the streets of Prague. And so he couldn't go back for his own safety. So I think he had to get his producer to go back. I think there's a really nice little brief summary of what happened with him or how he had to kind of navigate around that. But it's, it is interesting that it's the last film that Forman did before he finally transitioned to the United States. And then of course, found a lot of success with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Hair and Amadeus
and The People versus Larry Flint.
Yeah. And that's what's interesting too. Like, I think it's, he's maybe the only person from the Czech New Wave to like really break out of the Czech New Wave and like have a career in Hollywood, to have kind of that breakout success that international success.
Yeah, because I don't think like filmmakers like Jan Niemek were quite as successful, you know, because I think about like his, I don't know how much you know about this, but yeah, with A Report on the Partying Guests, that he was already considered a very controversial director, enough as it was. But this movie, you know, got him in even more trouble with the government. It actually was banned initially in 66, and it was briefly brought back to Czechoslovakia during the Prague Spring, only to be banned again from the country and wouldn't be shown in his homeland for another 20 years, and eventually had to leave Czechoslovakia in 74.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, but that was very much, you know, kind of par for the course with a lot of Czech filmmakers. There's a great, great film from 1970 called The Ear, Uko. And that was directed by Karol Kačinija. I apologize. My Czech is not up to snuff, but
I think you need to get checked.
But in any case, but that was a film that was actually, he made it in 1970, and then that wasn't released until after the fall of the communist regime in 89. So that was happening a lot, you know, with a lot of these filmmakers. And that was kind of, and I can empathize, you know, with filmmakers like Forman, you know, coming to Cannes and like having this film and like, you know, trying to like utilize it to like gain some sort of an international platform, because I mean, that's something that was so difficult, you know, to do in their own country. But in comparison, then Jan Nimitz, he was not, what for him, like just comparing the two, like what was it about his style that differentiated itself?
That's a good question. I think when compared to just, because I haven't seen as much of Nimitz's work as I have a Forman, but.
Oh, definitely. I was going to say the one I haven't seen it yet myself, but the one I really want to see is Diamonds of the Night. That one I know it's really kind of gained a huge profile in the last few years here in the States, and it's kind of.
Yeah. I heard it's also very highly well regarded. But, you know, just comparing this to The Fireman's Ball, like, the comedy isn't as broad, though it also doesn't have pathos in it either. It's, for those of you who have never seen it before, it's essentially about this group of seven people who, you know, we don't really know a whole lot about their backgrounds or anything, but from what we can gather, they seem to be like really well-off, affluent people, judging by how they dress and the way they act with their posh mannerisms. They're having this picnic, and all of a sudden, they kind of notice what seems to be a large group gathering occurring, what seems like a wedding. So they decide to go and check it out. And then they cross paths with other people in the woods who, you know, are kind of teasing and harassing them. But there's this kind of unease and uncertainty where you, for a while, you don't know if this is going to go south real bad or not. But yeah, it's a fable, but it's a parable and lots of themes about, like, class and politics and also relationships, marriage. And it's more, I would say it's more kind of, it's more scathing and it's more cynical of its characters, of its figures in this movie. And I can see how with this movie it would piss off a lot of government officials, the way he would talk about, he would allude to his country and the government. Like, there are such lines like, for instance, when a character's talking about table placement, the character says, like, there's a scoundrel on the left side here, and there's a scoundrel on the right side over here. Or, like, when they talk about how they saw the group gathering, what looks like a wedding gathering, they said, oh, yeah, we could see them on the hill. And they're like, somebody's like, oh, isn't that nice, you know? They saw you from above, and they saw you from below. So, yeah, it's very allegorical, and the impression I get from him is, like, even with some of his philosophies and mindset, I mean, you said, like, a lot of those Czech and filmmakers during the time period were very allegorical, and they're not grounded in realism, but he kind of reminds me of Fellini, and actually he was attacked by, you know, The 1967 National Assembly had banned his film, along with Vera Chitilova's Daisies, on the grounds of, quote, that the films have, both films have nothing in common with our republic, socialism, and the ideas of communism.
Yeah, no, Daisies is great. I highly recommend Daisies if you've never seen it. It's a real trip of a movie.
But I wanted to couple that with then a line that Nemec himself said, which I think kind of almost seems to say, like, well, of course, you know, it's not supposed to be realistic. He said his intention is to create a world independent of reality as it appears at the time.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. The one thing I wanted to say too is that, because these films are very much both the Fireman's Ball and, the Nemec film is that they're both, again, operating within the context of the Czech New Wave. But I think what's interesting in the context of the festival, of the Cannes Festival of 68, is that, you know, they are very much engaged with the question of an untenable social order. Or something that's, you know, this hegemonic figurehead that's less than sound. It's interesting, actually, you know, this is an altogether very different, and I do mean very different, example in a lot of ways. But at the same time, I think it operates within a similar sense of political engagement with the dominant political power. There's a film, the last film actually that was screened in Cannes, the very last film that was screened before Truffaut and Godard officially came up and they announced that the festival was canceled, was a film that was screened during the Critics Week in 68. It was called The Rocky Road to Dublin. It's a documentary, actually. It's by Peter Lennon. So essentially, like, the film is sort of a portrait of Ireland, and it's trying to sort of question or pose the question of, like, how do you contend with liberation? How do you move forward once you've been liberated? And this film sort of presents a pretty critical view of how the government structure, particularly in its relationship with the amount of power afforded to the Catholic Church, it's actually quite critical in terms of how that's sort of still casting the sway over Irish life. And so what's interesting about this film too is that it was a film that it was actually banned in Ireland. It was banned for more than 30 years and it didn't end up. And so I do feel really bad for the director Paul Lennon, you know, because you're making this film about a very tentative moment in your country, and it just gets sort of superseded or almost eclipsed, really, by a tumultuous political moment in another country. And then the consequence is that it barely is shown for decades after that. I mean, thankfully, the film has been since restored, and thankfully it's, you know, slowly been shown, in a wider capacity in the last 15 years. But, it really was a film that was, it was very, very hard to find. And, I think it's so interesting that it's reinforcing this sense of unease or this uncertainty in a political and social transition. You know, it's all these films in a way, the ones that we've been kind of talking about, you know, are presenting the world as one which is in this state of flux, which is undergoing something of a paradigmatic shift. And how do you undergo that shift if you're actually transformed, or if you're fulfilling the old maxim, the cynical maxim of the more things change, the more they stay the same?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, that's exactly how I would summarize the film selections from what I've seen of Cannes 68 as essentially a world in turmoil, coming to having an identity crisis, struggling to come to terms with what kind of world it's going to be for its people moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Although I will say this, like, this has, I think that's all I mean, I completely agree, and I think that's really great. It's a great way to really summarize kind of what how the world is being mirrored or channeled through the prism of some of these films in 68. Though I will say, if you're looking, you know, if you're there is still quite an eclectic selection of films there, you know, and if anybody's if you're looking for like, for example, like, you know, I mentioned earlier last year had like more focus on genre fare. There was still a little bit of an emphasis on genre filmmaking in 68. And look no further if you want a good example of two films. Well, one's a feature, one's kind of a longer short. They are Kuroniko by Kaneto Shindo and Toby Dammit by Federico Fellini.
Oh, you saw Toby Dammit.
I did. And well, here's the thing. Toby Dammit was it was one of three short films that was made for this horror film anthology. The other two shorts were by Roger Vadim and Louis Malle. And they're all films that are or short films that are based off of Edgar Allan Poe stories. And so Toby Dammit is based off of a Poe story. And the story, it's I don't think it's one of the more well-known ones. The full name of it is, I think I want to say like Never Bet Your Head with the
I think
Devil.
it's never bet the devil your head.
Never Bet the Devil Your Head. And to me, I was like, well, that's a weird name for something. And it, you know, not to spoil too much, but it makes sense in the context.
I mean, Poe just wouldn't go around and call a story the Telltale Heart for nothing.
But what's interesting about it, something like Toby Dammit, in the context of like Fellini's work, because Fellini's, you know, always had this sort of carnivalesque, dreamlike quality to his imagery, and he's never strayed from indulging in the nightmarish elements of his films. But that being said, there's something really it's really interesting to see him fully embrace like the tropes of the horror genre with Toby Dammit. I mean, essentially, it's just it's kind of like, you know, it sort of opens like you know, Eight and a Half in La Dolce Vita, where it's about this kind of malcontent celebrity figure. In this case, it's a British movie star, and it's Terence Stamp, dubbed into French. And he's gone to Rome, and he's kind of at this party, and he's sort of malcontent, and he's depressed, and he's like drunk. And the whole time, he's also kind of like seeing this in the corner of his eye. Sometimes he sees this really truly frightening little girl, bouncing a white ball around. And he first sees her at the airport and you're like, what the fuck is that? You know? And then you realize later in an interview when he's describing, when he's being interviewed by somebody to talk about God and the devil, that his description of the devil is the description of this little girl with this white ball. So he keeps seeing the devil pop up and, yeah, it's eerie. It's a nice, eerie, nasty little gem from Fellini. It's, you know, it's still a minor entry, but definitely like, I think it'd be really interesting to watch that with Kuroniko, because Kuroniko is, it's much more in the vein of like a ghost story. And, I mean, it's been a few years since I've seen Kuroniko, but I remember when Criterion first released it, like, God, like almost 10 years ago now. And I was just thinking like, ooh, Japanese horror, this looks pretty good. And like, and Kuroniko, I remember very much like it was this gorgeous, rich, black and white fable about this mother and daughter who were brutally murdered by these itinerant samurai, and they come back as ghosts, and they essentially lure the samurai to their deaths as revenge.
Yeah, that sounds really creepy. They both sound quite creepy,
Oh,
but
they're very good. Very good. Like, if you know, for any of you who are listening who are in the mood for classic Con 68 horror programming, like watch those two back to back and you're gonna have a really great time.
yeah, I see that Toby Dammit, the anthology film it was a part of is called Spirits of the Dead, and from what I can gather from critical reception, it seemed like it was the best received of the three. Because I saw a critic's review describe to the Mall short story as tedious, and the other one, Roger Vadim, is the director Barbarella. That's all you need to know.
Wait, did Roger Vadim direct Barbarella? How did I never know that?
Yes, I believe he did. Which, yeah, it makes sense. It stars Jane Fonda, and he and Fonda were dating around the time.
Oh Oh my God, that's hilarious. Oh God, yeah, that's right.
So if you want to go laugh, it's like, oh, Roger Vadim doing Ghost Story. This should be funny.
Well, now, you know, he also did And God Created Women, which was a big, big hit on its time. But yeah, I think, you know, we should kind of think about closing thoughts in terms of like, what was some of the kind of the, maybe not the political as much, but certainly there were some seismic cultural aftermath, like after effects, I would say, that were felt in Cannes. Am I mistaken in that, or no?
Yes, there were, like, and you kind of alluded to this briefly, but actually, the year after the May movement and what have you in France, the Cannes Film Festival decided to establish the Director's Fortnight, which they described as, like, I think they described it as basically like a film that it seemed like it could be able to, the selection would be able to speak more to the people. Like Luc Mollet was described as saying, among the Cannes Film Festival different sections, the Director's Fortnight distinguishes itself by its freedom of thinking, its non-competitive character, and its true intention of sharing its films. So I think it's the idea of, I think because there was all this, you know, because there's a strong desire by figures like Godard and Truffaut to be in support of the people, that's sort of the Director's Fortnight sort of came out of it. And I haven't seen all the movies that have come out from the Director's Fortnight, but I know there have been some, like,
I mean, give yourself some credit, Alex. That's 50 years.
Yes. True. Very true. Though there have been some eclectic titles which have screened during the Director's Fortnight, such as last year we had The Lighthouse.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. Well, that's the thing, you know, it's one of those, I mean, the Director's Fortnight, yeah, I mean, I'm glad that you singled out The Lighthouse, but it's also given a platform to other directors like Bertrand Bonello as well. So it's really, you know, the Director's Fortnight, I think one can argue that it's sort of become more neutered in a way, in terms of just sort of the interchangeability of like certain things that end up getting screened. But with that being said, there is still kind of this level of adventurousness with the selection. And also it does have the impact of having some of the more memorable or notable programming choices that come out of the festival. And then people like, or like sometimes you can really discover a talent and you go like, well, where the hell has this person been this whole time?
Yeah, that's the thing, because even last year, looking at some of the lineups, because yeah, you're right, there have been like directors who, you know, are notable and they have a pretty steady career, you know, they're doing fine as it is, that their work screened here, like Takashi Miike, First Love last year. But then you also have others like Give Me Liberty, which was an independent film about like this about a care worker who does metro driving. Like he drives around and picks up different people who need to be picked up and transported to go to places, and it's like these a few very hectic and chaotic days in this young guy's life. With some of the filmmaking that I was very impressed with too. So yeah, you're right. Sometimes, every now and then you get some people, you know, these filmmakers who come in and then they just bring out these works that, you know, with a fresh voice.
Well, exactly. You get, I mean, you know, for goodness sakes, like that's how you would get people like Michael Haneke and Atom Egoyan and even Roberto Benigni had a film entered the Director's Fortnight in the late 80s, Il Piccolo Diavolo. It has provided something of an outlet. Actually, I will say the one thing I was very happy to find out was that Head, the Bob Raffleson Monkees movie, was in the first year of the Director's Fortnight. And
no kidding.
That's so perfect, you know, to me, like that in a film like that, you know, as a potential, you know, as an aspiring programmer myself, if I were to like pick a place for a movie like Head, which I love that movie, but I would like, you know, and I would want to ensure that it would find as wide an audience as it could. Like that's so great that it's kind of like placing that, because then you have the opportunity for people to like stumble upon it, and you know, after they see it, they get over for drinks and they're like, so what did you see? And then someone would be like, oh, I saw like some sort of esoteric art house movie. What did you see? I saw the weirdest fucking movie where the monkeys were caught in this dude's hair and pushing dandruff out of the way.
Or like in 92, some of the films they had screened during the director's fortnight included Bob Roberts, which was directed by Tim Robbins, who would also go on to direct some other well-regarded films like Dead Man Walking. And then you had also Mac by John Turturro, who would actually receive the Golden Camera for that movie. And last but not least, one of Michael Haneke's pictures, Benny's Video.
Well, Benny's Video and The Seventh Continent, both were in the director's fortnight.
So it's like when you say like head, it's like you thought that film was messed up.
Yeah, I think it's something also that when we look back at the legacy of May 68, I mean, it's something, I was looking through an article from Internationale Situationnelle in September of 69. And they wrote something that I thought was really kind of, I thought it was actually really poignant, not just in terms of the context of May 68, but even for now, I think is something that, we can keep in mind. And the quotes that they wrote, this quote, "The movement was a rediscovery of collective and individual history, an awakening to the possibility of intervening in history, an awareness of participating in an irreversible event." And this is the key moment, I think, the key part of the quote. They say, "People looked back in amusement at the strange existence they had led a week before, at their outlived survival. It was a passion for bringing everything and everyone together that included a holistic critique of all alienations, of all ideologies, and of the entire old organization of real life. What awakened in the spring of 68 was nothing other than what had been sleeping in the night of the specular society, whose spectacles presented nothing but an eternal positive facade."
That's a beautiful way to put it, and I think it's quite apt. When I think of May 68 France, it reminds me of something I also heard. There was a common misconception by people, who like to mythologize or romanticize it. There's a common misconception that it was primarily a movement set by post baby boomer youth against, it was them versus the elders that came beforehand. But that wasn't quite necessarily the case, because as we alluded to before, it wasn't just students that were involved in the movement. In fact, there was a large number of workers that were involved too. In fact, it even peaked to, I believe, the number of workers that were on strike apparently got sized between 7 and 13 million. So when I think of the movement, even though I think the degree of like how much positive or negative impact it had on the country, I think that is open for discussion. I feel like what one can take from it is like showing the power of truly that comes from unity, from different walks of life, when people come together with ideas of like of change and how they feel a sense of connection. There, when the invisible barriers of isolation give way, and there's a more of a collective attitude, and I think that sort of that advocacy for unity, I think is extremely significant. Especially now more than ever.
Well, and like I was saying, it's again about reorienting what was once taken for granted as the singular way of thinking about the world or of seeing the world. And I think in that respect, I mean, isn't that what cinema is for? Cinema is about helping us process the world and helping us look at the world. And if the way we see the world is changing, then cinema should be changing as well. I mean, at least that's what I think. Who knows? Maybe you guys can, give it a think about that. Let us know in the comments or with angry emails saying, "Oh, these guys are full of shit."
Yeah. They are the enfant terrible of film criticism.
Yeah. Look at you enfants terribles over there. Well, I think that's a pretty apt summation of a fairly complex topic. But for anybody, for all of you guys listening out there, with any thoughts or other stories about May 68 or about other festivals that were canceled because of revolution or pandemics or whatever the case, you know, leave the comments, leave your comments in the boxes below and let us know what you think. You know, we'd love to hear what you guys have to say because, I mean, after all, we're always looking to generate more conversation about cinema and its place in history. But for now, I just wanted to say thanks, Alex, for getting this going. I'm really glad we had the chance to talk about this.
Well, thank you for helping make this possible. I'm really glad we could be able to do this too.
I do miss Con, but I do not miss standing in line, surrounded by very irritable, caffeine-deprived people.
Yeah. Hopefully someday I'll be lucky to stand in line behind caffeine-deprived people at Con. You know, someday.
You know, lucky is hardly the word to even begin to describe it.
Well, yeah, and I just want to say, too, please check up on KuiFilms.com or also look into our Facebook page for updates whenever we post either another one of these podcasts or film reviews. And, yeah, we always like to keep the conversation going. We're all in this together. And thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for tuning in, guys. Take care and watch good movies.